தாக்கிட்டத்தக்க தொமுக்கிட்ட தொமுக்கிட்டத்தக்க தெத்தா திட்டக்கத்த கதிகன தக்கிட்ட தக்கிட்ட தக்க கிட்டத்தக்க தொமுக்கிட்ட தொமுக்கிட்டத்தக்க தெத்தா தா தா தாதி கிட்டத்தக்க தென தாதி கிட்டத்தக்க தென தாதி கிட்டத்தக்க தென தாதி கிட்டத்தக்க.
This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being.
Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease.
Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socio-economics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. We are moving on to bowel habits. Dr. Jan Gurley, internist, will give us an overview of the gastrointestinal tract.
You're only as good as your weakest sphincter.
Dr. Nrupendra Dhillon, anatomy professor, goes into further detail about how things work.
Stuff goes in one end, comes out the other end.
And a generous cousin who shares with us her own observations of how things go for her.
On a good day, you know, when I'm slept well and whatnot, there's no pushing. It's a brown banana.
First, some news. The World Health Organization reports a widespread cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe. Inadequate access to safe drinking water is threatening the health of thousands of Zimbabweans. This outbreak appears to be one of the world's largest ever recorded. An enhanced response is urgently needed to reverse an epidemic that has so far infected more than 60,000 people and killed more than 3,000 since August of 2008. Although the case fatality rate has decreased slightly, it is still above 5%, with about three times more deaths being recorded at community level rather than within health facilities. Neighboring South Africa has also reported 3,000 cases, but the strength of its healthcare and water and sanitation systems have seen the case fatality rate remain below 1%. Shortages of medicines, equipment, and staff are exacerbating the health challenges. Unless drastic action is taken by all players in this crisis, more Zimbabweans will succumb to the outbreak, and other countries in the Southern African region will face the continued threat of spillover epidemics. Urgent measures needed in Zimbabwe include increasing awareness, particularly at the grassroots level, regarding prevention and treatment measures. Most recorded deaths have occurred at home, which means that more effective messaging directed at all communities, particularly the remotest parts of the country, is crucial for the Zimbabwean public to be best prepared to act against the epidemic. More medicines need to be made available at the community level, particularly oral rehydration salts, so healthcare workers and ordinary people themselves have the means to quickly treat cases of cholera that emerge. One of the greatest challenges is ensuring people can access health services, as this is not possible for many people due to limited access to transport or money to pay for the trip to the health facility. Stocks of simple yet life-saving supplies must be provided to each community. Another very important measure that should be emphasized is the urgent need to create water sanitation infrastructure to prevent the continued spread of not only cholera, but other waterborne diseases. Also, mobilizing resources to pay thousands of Zimbabwean doctors, nurses, and other health staff who have been unable to obtain salaries and have not had enough money for basic needs, such as buying a bus ticket to get to work. This vacuum in availability of national health staff is a factor in the increasing number of cholera sufferers dying. Zimbabwe also needs to open access to more non-governmental organizations to respond to the cholera outbreak. Currently, NGOs are operating large numbers of cholera treatment centers and units in areas where other support, including governmental support, is not available. We are dealing with an extraordinary public health crisis that requires from us all an extraordinary public health emergency response. And this must happen now before the outbreak causes more needless suffering and death, Dr. LaRoche said. Political differences need to be put aside, economic barriers overcome, health services in the country's periphery strengthened, and community awareness to respond enhanced to save many more people from dying due to a disease that can be readily prevented and treated. The Rising Nepal reports that surveys on water and sanitation carried out by different government and private organizations and the UN Habitat Water for Asian Cities program in Nepal showed that 59% of public and community schools across the country did not have a toilet. This dearth of toilets has contributed to the increasing rate of girl dropouts per year before reaching the secondary level of education. The rate of girl dropouts has increased by 6% in the span of 7 years. The dropout rate in 2001 was 6.5%. It rose to 12.5% in 2007. The report stated that although 148,000 toilets are constructed annually in the country, only 10% of poor people have access to toilets. 54% of the population still defecates in open spaces. Similarly, 13,000 children under the age of 5 die annually because of diarrheal waterborne diseases like cholera, which are caused mainly by poor sanitation and hygiene. Rajesh Manantar, Water and Sanitation Coordinator of Water for Asian Cities Program Nepal, said that currently in Nepal, about half of the urban households are without basic facilities of safely supplied drinking water and a sanitary system. In this issue, we welcome guest tabla artist Nikhil Pandya. Dr. Jan Gurley is a practicing internist at the Tom Waddell Health Center for the Homeless in San Francisco. She is also a health humorist and as such gives us a delightful overview of a journey through the gastrointestinal tract. Dr. Gurley, I'm pleased that you've offered me this interview about the gut.
Well, you know, I like to get to the guts of the matter, so we'll just delve right in.
All right. Before we really get into the nitty-gritty of it, I just wanted to review the anatomy of the GI tract.
So here's the tricky thing. You have to imagine that you're a giant water hose, and you're actually empty on the inside. You can imagine you're made out of silly putty, and somebody's pulled those little arms and legs off the hose, and a little head is poking out the top. But then the inside is this tube that just goes all the way through. And then about halfway through, it starts to coil and twist and twist and coil and twist and coil. Most people don't know this, but we are all actually hollow.
This is kind of a new perspective. And I'm not going to take this as like a personal insult. You're not really calling me hollow.
not in any spiritual or moral sense. But physiologically and stool-wise, you actually are hollow. And we all are.
Well, I suppose hollow is better than shallow.
That's true. The funny thing about being hollow is that your guts are actually the outside world, and they're full of all the things that are in the outside world, especially germs. Most of us don't realize that we're carrying around somewhere between 2 and 5 pounds of germs, and they are our friends. We often think that, sure, we eat something, but it must get sterilized. But once you know you're hollow, you realize it's probably not truly sterilized.
You mean the food is not sterilized?
Food comes with germs. There's no sterile food that we're eating. It's all germy. And most of them are good germs, and we like that. And when you get to your stomach, your body does a really good job at trying to sterilize things. But especially if you're on an acid suppressor or you're older and you just don't make as much acid, maybe you're just not as feisty and burny as you used to be, then you just don't sterilize that stuff.
This is very interesting. This whole hollow tube that we are, what's the beginning?
Okay, so we're going to pretend we're taking the incredible journey, and we're going to go inside ourselves. In this case, we'll use meat as the example. So imagine you're in a spoon, and I first take whatever it is that's in that spoon, and I chew the living daylights out of it. And in the process, you pulverize most of it. And you also mix it with your saliva, which has its own digestive enzymes and some protective antibodies.
And are you supposed to chew how many times? 32 times? 25 times? 80 times?
So this falls in the category of a button I love that says, will not obsess, will not obsess, will not obsess. So we try to not obsess about obsessing, But trying to count how many times you chew is probably also going to ruin your ability to truly savor your food. It's good to enjoy the moment and take your time. And then once you swallow it, it slides straight down your throat and right between your lungs until it lands in a splash in your stomach.
This slide down the esophagus, is it just a free fall or is there some function for the esophagus? I mean, is the esophagus doing anything?
Your esophagus is actually pushing things along, and it pushes things along in a pretty sophisticated conveyor belt. And if you have a spasm or it goes backwards, believe me, you would know it right away. It would be a malfunction. But most of us are completely oblivious to the fact that your body is doing this really complicated thing. Not only is it pushing it along in little waves to make sure all of it goes in the right direction, there's even a trap door at the bottom to make sure that everything goes through and nothing splashes back up.
And do we have a trapdoor at the top as well?
What we actually have is a trapdoor for our lungs to make sure things don't take a wrong turn. And again, as we all know, if it does take a wrong turn, you know it right away. People tend to cough their brains out if food or spit or anything else goes the wrong way.
We have to chew our food really thoroughly to make our entrance into the esophagus. The esophagus pushes things along in a wave-like motion, which we call peristalsis. And then you get to the trapdoor right before the stomach, the esophageal sphincter.
I had a medical school professor who told us, and I love this phrase, you're only as good as your weakest sphincter, which means that all of us probably have one weak link in our chain of sphincters. And so if your weakest sphincter is right at your esophagus, you can get a lot of what's called reflux. But in general, most people, it works really well. And if you want to know when your trapdoor has opened, just burp.
Is there any importance to sitting up while you're eating? Can the esophagus still push things along even if you're lying down?
It's really a bad idea to eat lying down. Your body puts a lot of effort into pushing your food along, but there's no reason to destroy a well-designed system. It's not really meant to be an anti-gravity device. And when you lie down, not only do you make your body work harder, you massively increase your chances of having that food take a wrong turn into your lungs. And you don't have to be frail or elderly or diseased or anything for that to happen. It just doesn't go past that special trapdoor that's protecting your lungs. So if you're lying flat on your back, eating your croissant, and someone says something funny and you laugh, there's a really good chance you're going to have some croissant in your lung.
So this trapdoor at the bottom of the esophagus, the esophageal sphincter, how well does it close? So if the food has gone into your stomach and then you decide 5 minutes later that it's time to do a headstand, is that trapdoor going to stay closed?
Unfortunately, no. It is not the tightest, or you'll have to pardon me for this phrase, it is not the most anal of sphincters. It just kind of flops sideways. So you kind of want to give it a little help. Staying upright and letting your food digest is really important to make sure nothing goes backwards.
So let's talk about the stomach.
Now the stomach, as most people know, sits right under your ribs. And sometimes you can even, especially in babies, see it sort of bulge when people eat. When your food is sitting in your stomach, it's like a car wash. All this stuff is being sprayed in there. And for the most part, it is incredibly acidic. Your stomach is starting the first process of breaking down this food, not mechanically, which is what your teeth did, but chemically. And what's more, that acid will kill off a huge number of germs, including germs that could be resistant to a lot of things like antibiotics. It's hard for a germ to resist acid.
Do you know how acidic it is?
Down to a pH of 2.
Whoa.
Yeah. So you can like dissolve a nail down there. You wouldn't want to do that, of course. And that's why if there's any backward flow up your esophagus is not happy. It gets really inflamed and really raw.
What happens if you eat too much? Can all of that acid still dissolve a very, very large amount of food?
Well, what we found is that if you overfill your stomach over time will try to stretch to accommodate it and lose some of its tone. But at the same time, you cannot produce enough acid to really compensate for rapidly overeating. Just like you want to nurture yourself by savoring your food, you also want to pace yourself while you're eating. There's no downside to taking your time over your food, except possibly the irritation of your friends who have gulped theirs down and are ready to run on to the next frantic activity.
So when you overeat, does that also contribute to the esophageal sphincter opening up and food coming back up?
Oh, yes. Like I said, that esophageal sphincter isn't the tightest of our sphincters, and so it can definitely open up. People will often notice that. They'll burp and feel a little food come up, or they'll feel uncomfortable, and it's because the food and the acid is where it shouldn't be.
And you would think this extremely acidic environment would destroy tough parasites too, but somehow those parasites can make it past, and a lot of bacteria too that are pathogenic.
Yeah, germs will get by even the most acidic stomach if they're bad enough germs. And you know, with the parasites, they've obviously adapted very well, and they oftentimes, their little spores and eggs have really tough coating. Some of them actually have evolved to the point where they need the acid to be activated and allowed to hatch, which is really kind of creepy.
Kind of makes you also not want to use antacids.
Yeah, you know, there have been a lot of studies looking at that, and actually about the only thing they found is that it may slightly increase your risk for some rare diseases like tuberculosis. But in our country, the United States, it hasn't made a huge difference in people's physical health, and it has helped them with some symptoms.
And there's a sphincter at the other end of the stomach as well that keeps the whole sack of acid mulching process in one place, the pyloric sphincter. What's the story on that?
Well, the stomach is truly a way station. You know, you're in the spoon, you get masticated, you free fall and get pushed along into the stomach, you splash down, and then like being at the DMV, you wait and you wait and you wait. You can only go one direction and you have to wait for the pyloric sphincter to open. And when it opens, it only lets a little bit through. And the funny thing is that we don't have great nerves for this part of our body. So our sense of fullness often comes a long time after we're actually full. So in general, if you just keep waiting for your body to say, oh, I'm overstuffed, most of us realize by the time we're out of our teenage years that that's not really a good measure of when you're full. And so we subconsciously tend to pay attention to volume of what we're eating and not just wait for this sense of, oh, I'm overstuffed, because it tends to come pretty late. And that pyloric sphincter will open and a little bit of this acidified mush will squirt through, and then it goes to this really interesting place called the duodenum, or the duodenum, depending on how you want to pronounce it. The next station is where the detergent comes in that breaks down your fat. You take all this goopy acidic stuff and you dash through that pyloric sphincter and you're in this tiny curve. At this point, it's turning into that garden hose looking inside of a tube. And there's another whole car wash spraying function that happens. And this is when your gallbladder squirts green stuff everywhere. And that's your bile. And if any of you, and I hope not, have ever had one of those hideous food poisoning episodes where you puke, puke, puke until you have nothing, and then God help you, you puke some more, up comes this weird neon greeny chartreuse colored stuff. And it feels very slick. And that's because it is literally soap. It's what digests all your fat.
And so the gallbladder will squirt this bile into the duodenum. But what's the signal for the pyloric sphincter to open up?
Your fat content may in some way regulate how much goes through and how quickly. Because if you eat really fatty French fries, you're going to need a lot of bile, and it's going to take a lot of time for it to churn around and mix up. Your body actually squirts different amounts of bile depending on what you ate, and it also squirts it more forcefully if you eat more fat.
It's like you need more detergent to wash a greasy pan.
You definitely do, and it does weirdly look like neon dishwashing detergent. People may not know this. Your body is the ultimate reuse recycle machine. Your bile, it's like leftover dish rags. It gets taken out of the used and destroyed parts of your blood and has to be packaged and reprocessed in your liver and recreated as bile. That's where your bile comes from. And when it's mixed really well, those fat droplets are reduced to tiny little microscopic size called micelles. They're almost a foam because they're so tiny.
Okay, so the bile's gone in there and washed up all the fat, broken it down into little tiny, tiny little fat particles. And then what happens?
So if you're still imagining you're on this trip, you've turned into the duodenum, you're doing this giant curve around, like being on a water world ride, and then as you go around that curve and you head into the small intestines, you have literally 30 feet of curves to go through. And during that whole process, you're passing through these tunnels with these fingers hanging down. Your guts have these thing called cilia. And in each of these fingers are these tiny little cells that line the wall of your guts. And their jobs, if you can imagine them as little work women and work men, is to reach into this mush and pull out everything valuable for your body. And unfortunately, if they got nothing but Cheetos to work with, they're not happy because they're fishing through a lot of stuff and they're not finding anything good. And they'll grab fat molecules, whether they need any or not. They'll just keep grabbing them. And they'll keep digging around looking for important vitamins and minerals. That's what they really love, is when there's some of those packed in the food too. The thing they won't touch, though, is what we call fiber. It's the undigestible parts of your food. It's neither fatty, nor vitamins, nor minerals, nor carbohydrates. It's pretty much like the roughage that cows are chewing constantly. It's the thing that your body can't digest.
So these cilia are kind of like dumpster divers, and they want to dumpster dive in Beverly Hills and not in the ghetto.
That is absolutely right. They only want the prime ingredients, and I have to tell you, they're probably a little lazy. They do pick up everything that's worthwhile, but they are really unhappy if all you're giving them is essentially garbage to work with. It's that they can get flattened, they can get damaged, and if you have a food allergy that's attacking them back, they are really unhappy about that. And they're also constantly fighting these germs, because you have to remember, you're still on the outside world. The inside of your guts are still the outside world. So there are some germs, like the cholera outbreak we're hearing about in Africa, where a germ actually makes all those little workers go backwards and throw everything back into your guts. And so you start losing fluid and nutrients and minerals that you need.
They're taking things from your blood and putting it into your gut.
And people get very sick when that happens, which tells you just how much work they're doing and just how efficient they are at only working in one direction under normal circumstances.
So we've got germs in this mush that are from the outside, but then we've got also germs that actually live there, and that's their home, and they compete with the germs from the outside too.
Oh, yes. What you want are nice, happy, good germs. They're like having good tenants in your building, and they take good care of you, and everything increases in value when you have them. What you don't want are the marauding vandals, and when they get in there, they destroy things. And what is really true is that if you're already full, if there's a no vacancy sign out because you have all good germs, then it's much harder for those marauding vandals to move in.
So we got 30 feet of small intestine to work through, and is there any pathway, or are they all just curled up?
They're pretty much curled up. And what's interesting is it always goes forward. And if you ever want to see how quickly your guts work, just have a great meal of roasted beets. You'll be able to tell exactly when it comes out.
So after the small intestine, where do we go from there?
We have another sort of sphincter. This one is almost, it's not really actually a sphincter. It doesn't seem to be very tight at all.
The cecal valve.
It's the cecal valve. Thank you, doctor. Yes, you have your cecal valve, which is, again, not as tight, but it is a marker, and it does help your body keep things from going backwards. And then when you dump into your large intestines, things change. Instead of being this little garden hose tube with all these cilia inside it, you're suddenly into this wide open space that's packed full, like a concert hall, with germs. Millions and millions and millions of germs. And what's dumping into there, because your body has pushed not just bile, but all these digestive enzymes in there, what's coming into your large intestines is looking like watery Jamba Juice stuff. It's not really a poop like you think of it as a poop. It's actually pretty liquid and slushy.
It's like sludge. And all the good stuff has been taken out, hasn't it?
It very much has. Your body's very efficient. What's left behind are all these digestive enzymes, the soapy bile, and fiber. It's what helps keep things going. If you just have essentially nothing but germs, what you're going to end up with is rocks. Fiber is what keeps it hydrated and soft, because the large intestines, you need to think of them on our little journey through here as being the Sahara Desert of your guts. Because within your large intestines, your body has a margin of error of 5%. Now imagine that. Your large intestines work at over 95% efficiency all the time. That means that what dumps into the beginning of your large intestines can be as much as 4 to 5 liters of stool. And what comes out has been processed down to less than 5% of that, because what your large intestines do mostly is suck up everything that's worthwhile, but mostly fluid, to your body before your poop comes out.
It kind of helps you to keep hydrated. You've had all this liquid come in, and if you were to just let it run through,
you would lose gobs of fluid. And that's why, unfortunately, and very sadly, people with cholera die.
If we were to use that car wash analogy, we've sprayed out the detergents and we've gotten all the good stuff out, and now we're going through the drying process.
Not only the drying process, but there's this really efficient drain in the floor, and it's not just passively draining things, it's sucking everything back up to reuse. Like I said, your body is a very efficient recycle reuser of everything. It doesn't waste anything it has any possible use for.
And all those germs in the large intestines are also processing all that fiber, and all their metabolism is what's giving us gas.
It's actually a really important stage. They help digest down these large chunks of undigestible food. They are actually eating this stuff and farting out their own tiny farts, and all their little tiny farts together add up to your fart. And they're your best friends. They are really doing a lot of the work that your body hasn't been able to do. In fact, we're so intimately tied with the germs of our guts that you could think of us as partners. We both benefit from this relationship, and you don't want an abusive relationship. And your large intestine is this giant U-shape that goes from the bottom of one hip up under your diaphragm and then down to the bottom of your other hip and then obviously out your anus. But in that process, the food that's in it changes dramatically, so that from the beginning of your large intestines to the end of your large intestines, you start with stuff that looks like a Jamba Juice sludge and you end with stuff that looks like what you see in your toilet. It's an amazing transformation in what is really a relatively short amount of space.
Do each of the sections, like the upgoing section, the across-going section, the transverse section, and the downgoing section, the descending section, do they have different functions?
They do have very different functions. And if, unfortunately, you had to lose one part of it, it could or could not have an impact on your health, depending on which part you lost. And you need to have a certain length, too, for it to be able to perform this magic, because it doesn't have a lot of length to start with.
And then we get to the sigmoid colon. The last little bit before we get to the anal sphincter. What's so special about the sigmoid colon?
The same professor who told all of us that you're only as good as your weakest sphincter, he loved the colon and the anus. And what he would talk about is how it is the most intelligent part of your body, because your sigmoid colon and your anus can tell the difference without anyone knowing how between a stool and gas. If you're farting, you generally don't lose any stool when you do it. And what's more, this whole process of learning how to control your stool is a neuroendocrine function that takes humans about a year to figure out how to do. And your colon is sampling itself to find out if there's more air or more stool and what you should do about it, and sending you signals, but at the same time not being a bully. It lets you choose what you want to do about it. And it is one of the most amazing relationships you have with your body that you can imagine when you really sit down and think about it. So your sigmoid colon is, just to be clear, is the part that connects from the downward part at the bottom of your hip. It curls around like the letter S, which is why I like the word sigmoid. It gives you a visual for what it is, down your hip and out to your anus. And then your anal sphincter is obviously the sphincter that we all know and joke about the most. And there is a fair amount of difference in individual people's anal tone, as we call it. And it's no joke when it stops working well. It also weirdly has a lot of ramifications for how we see ourselves and how we see our world. And there are a lot of not subtle jokes that people make about it. It is tied to that whole function of, you know, who's in charge, your body or yourself. That battle is played out by your anal sphincter constantly, more than almost any other part of your body. It's often a place that sort of, if you'll pardon the phrase, rears its head as a source of concern or a symbol for things in people's lives.
This has been a fascinating and wonderful journey through your gut.
I like to think of them as pretty, too.
It's been very scenic.
Yeah, it's definitely a multi-sensory experience.
I had a gut feeling it was going to be good to have you explain the gut to us.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. Dr. Jan Gurley, internist and health humorist. Dr. Nripendra Dhillon has won many teaching awards as an anatomy professor at the University of California, San Francisco. He gives us some more of the nitty-gritty of how the gut works. Dr. Dhillon, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
My pleasure.
As you know, we are moving on from our series on habits and addictions to bowel habits. I'd like it if you could give us an overview or a review of the anatomy and function of the GI tract.
Sure, my pleasure. I'd be happy to. So it's a tube starting at the mouth and running all the way down to the anus. Stuff goes in one end, comes out the other end, and in the process, our body sucks the nutrition out of it, and of course sucks any bad stuff out of it too, depending on what we've ingested. The mouth, with its teeth and the tongue, the salivary glands in our mouth will typically add saliva into the food that we're chewing, softens it up, makes it a softer consistency, adds a couple of enzymes to it that start to break down carbohydrates. So the beginning of food digestion actually starts in the mouth right after chewing. The esophagus, which is the next structure down, is basically a structure that conducts food. There is a little sphincter, a squishy part of the bottom end of the esophagus, if you will, that may control how much food enters the stomach, but more controls the stuff that's in the stomach, prevents it from coming up into the esophagus. So the food eventually reaches the stomach, where it starts to get processed by the acid present in the stomach. The acid in the stomach helps really break the food down into smaller parts, add a certain enzyme into the food that starts to break proteins down. That's called pepsin. The acid in the stomach also starts the absorption of certain substances, specifically alcohol. Alcohol gets easily absorbed in the stomach. Aspirin that we take by mouth usually gets absorbed in the stomach. Most of the rest of the absorption of other things that we eat happens in the small intestine.
So this esophageal sphincter that prevents things from coming back into the esophagus, what controls how it works? Because it seems like a lot of people have this acid reflux into the esophagus and the sour burps.
A lot of folks think of heartburn as being too much acid, probably more a function of not enough acid. Not having enough acid in our stomach is bad. And having too much acid probably doesn't happen as often.
How would not having enough acid contribute to the heartburn?
Not having enough acid in the stomach, you know, with the effects that it has on bacterial flora. I mean, we have lots of good bacteria in our GI tract, and the acidity of the stomach and the resultant pH that it produces, not just in the stomach, but farther down in the GI tract, that controls all of these bugs that are good and bad in our GI tract.
So can you tell me what nerves innervate that sphincter? Because it seems like more people get reflux when they're stressed. And so how does the nervous system relate to the function of that sphincter?
Sure. Maybe I can talk about the nervous system, not just as far as sphincter is concerned, but kind of its effect on the GI tract as a whole. There's two parts to our nervous system that control internal organs. It's called the autonomic nervous system. And the two parts are the sympathetic part and the parasympathetic part. These are different nerves than the nerves that control muscle movement, say moving an arm or a leg or blinking an eye. The nerves that go to our internal organs are typically making movement for organs that are out of our control, hence the name autonomic nervous system. Parasympathetics, just to simplify them, are the rest and digest part of our nervous system. The sympathetics also play a role. They are more the fight or flight part of our nervous system. Sympathetics do play a role in the internal functions of the GI tract also, insofar as they tend to simplify this, tend to pull blood away from the GI tract and divert it to the rest of the body. So in a fight or flight situation, our body wants to run from danger, and the goal there is to send more blood to the muscles that are going to be doing the running, as opposed to the GI tract, whose digestion functions can wait. And then the other role it plays is several sphincters along the way, including the esophageal sphincter that we were speaking of. Those sphincters, when they're open, they tend to allow food to go through. When they're closed, they slow down the digestive system, right? And so the sympathetics will tend to close off sphincters to slow digestive processes down, whereas, of course, the parasympathetics tend to do the opposite.
When the sympathetic nervous system kicks in, the parasympathetic nervous system kind of shuts off?
That's probably an accurate description. They tend to oppose each other's actions. When the sympathetics kick in a stressful situation, the parasympathetics would tend to shut down.
So we were in the stomach.
So now the foods in the stomach and in the stomach, the volume of fluid secreted by the stomach creates a paste. This paste is called chyme, that then is released by the stomach into the beginnings of the small intestine, the duodenum. There's another sphincter controlling the outflow of chyme, the pyloric sphincter. The pressure by the stomach churning chyme up inside of it, that pressure squirts out a little bit of chyme every time the pyloric sphincter releases.
Great, so a little bit of chyme at a time.
That's right. And so once this acidic mush reaches the duodenum, it sets off a couple of events. The first is it stimulates the organ called the pancreas that sits nestled within this C-shaped loop that the duodenum creates. If it weren't for the acid, the pancreas typically would not start doing anything. And then the other thing that the chyme does is, especially the amount of fat in the chyme, will then stimulate the gallbladder, which is nearby, to start dumping its secretions too. So we can talk about the gallbladder after the pancreas, but first the pancreas. That's an organ that has two major roles. One is referred to as the endocrine role of the pancreas, and then the other is the exocrine role of the pancreas. The exocrine role is what is going to be necessary for the digestive process. The endocrine role is to secrete a couple of hormones that control sugar metabolism, insulin being one of them, glucagon being another. And the biggest component of pancreatic secretions is bicarbonate. Bicarbonate is necessary to neutralize the acid that the stomach dumped into the duodenum. If it weren't for the bicarbonate, this acidic chyme that's passing through the duodenum will basically disallow all of the enzymes from doing their digestive work.
So the basic function of the pancreas is to secrete base to neutralize the acid.
That's right. And you know, the funny part is that a lot of times when people are talking about the pancreas, they'll talk about all the enzymes that it secretes. They'll talk about its role as far as endocrine function is concerned. But they never talk about the bicarbonate component, which is by far the biggest part.
Well, never say never, because we're doing it here.
That's right. Once this acid is neutralized, pancreas also secretes a bunch of enzymes that start to further the digestive process. Enzymes that help digest fat would be lipases. Enzymes that continue carbohydrate digestion would be amylases. And then there are other protein digestive enzymes called proteases. They start breaking the food components down into smaller absorbable parts. The liver, in response to a fatty meal, will typically send a bunch of bile, both directly from the liver and from the gallbladder that sits right underneath the liver. So the bile basically contains components that will help fat get digested. If you ever think putting fat and water, they don't mix. All of our secretions, at least chyme, mostly water-based. So our fat that we've taken by mouth would not be approachable by the digestive enzymes if it weren't for some way to get fat and water to mix. So in a manner that you get soap to get grease off your hands, similarly our bile acts as the soap agent that allows fatty substances in our food to mix with the fluid-based enzymes that the pancreas is secreting.
So what I'm getting is that in the mouth, we start dealing with carbohydrates. In the stomach, we start dealing with proteins. And then in the duodenum, we start dealing with the fats. I mean, if we were to just kind of break it down in general big subgroups.
Yes, as far as starting the digestive process is concerned, that's absolutely right. In the mouth, the carbohydrates, which is why a lot of food that has carbohydrates tends to start tasting sweet, because we're chewing it and those amylase is coming out from the salivary glands. They're starting to break it down, and those broken down products are now starting to taste sweet. And then, yes, the proteins start to get broken down in the stomach, and the fat starts to first get mixed into the chyme at the level where bile comes in.
Great. And then what happens?
So now you've got the digestive process kind of roaring along. And this digestive process mostly happens in the duodenum. You have to keep one thing in mind, that along the way between the stomach, the gallbladder, the liver, the pancreas, a lot of fluid has been dumped into the food that we've taken. This fluid is now going to pass into the farther parts of the small intestine, the first of the jejunum, and then subsequently the ileum. Those are the two places where most of the absorption of all of the digested food products is going to occur. By the tail end of the ileum, anything that was of nutritional value has been reabsorbed. And it turns out that all of this blood coming from our internal organs is going to end up in one big vein that's called the portal vein. And that vein passes through the liver. Everything that we take by mouth that is absorbed by our GI tract is going to get first carried through the liver. The liver is going to get the chance to look at all of the things that are going by it and decide what it wants to do. And that comes into play in the function of many drugs and how things are treated by our body.
So the liver will process all the nutrients that we get and also the toxins.
Absolutely. So the liver may see some sugar go by it and say, hey, I want to save this sugar for a rainy day, and it'll take the sugar and store it as glycogen. The liver may see a bad compound go by and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to change the shape of this bad compound. And compounds keep their activity by their chemical shape. When the liver changing the shape of these compounds basically changes their activity and makes them less harmful, the liver in effect has detoxified it.
Does the liver also dump some of these toxins back into the poop?
Sure. It's dumping a lot of these detoxified compounds into the bile, or it could take it, and even without doing anything to it, could dump it right back out into our bile. And of course, these things go out in poop. So it plays a big excretion role.
The liver can get overwhelmed sometimes by too many things to process?
Sure. The liver could get overwhelmed. Too much of a fatty meal, not all of it gets digested. And that undigested fat will typically go through the intestine, and then the intestinal bugs will act on it and typically produce lots of gas.
And with toxins too, the liver can get overwhelmed by a chemical, even a simple chemical like Tylenol. If you take too much of it, the liver can't handle it.
Absolutely.
I'm so glad you're going over the functions of these other organs that are part of our digestive system. It's really very useful.
Thank you. The rest of the GI tract then becomes pretty straightforward.
Straightforward, but rather convoluted as well.
Very convoluted, absolutely. It's got, you know, a good 16, 18 feet of a convoluted route down the abdominal cavity, eventually ending at the beginnings of the large intestine at the cecum, which is on the bottom right side of our abdominal cavity. The large intestine now gets this food, and this food now travels up from the bottom parts of our body and then across the middle of the abdominal cavity in something called the transverse colon, and then eventually down out the left side of the body in the descending colon, which leads to the rectum and the anal canal.
So how does the food actually go upwards?
So it's the movement of the muscular walls of both the small intestine and the large intestine that propels this food forwards. It's called peristalsis. If you imagine a tube that has got some mushy stuff inside of it, and you squish this tube with your hand, whatever's inside the tube is going to get squished to one side. So that's effectively how these muscles work. The large intestine's big role is absorbing all the water that the other parts of the GI tract have dumped into the food. And of course, now we start to make the beginnings of what will eventually become feces, which will eventually get stored in the rectum, where it's eventually released with a bowel movement.
How does the rectum or the anus know when to release?
So the rectum can store this feces. And then, of course, we pick a time and a place of our choosing to go back and have a bowel movement. The rectum will stretch to a certain degree. The stretching will set off receptors in the wall of the rectum that'll let the brain know that the rectum is filling. And then, of course, somewhat under our conscious control is the choice to go when we want to. And, of course, other times the choice is beyond us. We have to go right now.
Why would we have watery stools if the large intestine is doing its job?
The watery stools will typically happen in a couple of simplistically described situations. One is the large intestine is not doing its job. Two, the food is being hurried along much faster than normal through the tube. So an infection of the large intestine, for example, may want to rush stuff along. Typically, inflamed tissue tends to secrete its own extra fluid in there. So infected inflamed tissue, instead of absorbing fluid, may actually be adding fluid. So inflammatory bowel, infected bowel, and this typically produces the diarrhea.
Tell me about the innervation of the anal sphincter, too.
So anal sphincter, again, is two parts to it. One is a involuntary part, which is out of our control. And then the other is the voluntary part, which is a couple of different components. One being a part of our pelvic floor muscles, another being an active physically surrounding the anus external sphincter. So both those parts, they're under our control.
When we take our final breath, we also take our final poop. What's that connection?
That largely is a function of the voluntary sphincter given up. We keep our poop in our rectum largely by this external sphincter staying contracted and having a consistent tone at all times. Once we die, the nerves that innervate our arms and legs, they stop working, as do the same nerves that innervate the rectal sphincter. So when that sphincter relaxes, if there is some pressure built up inside the rectum at that point, that pressure just pushes the poop out. Now, of course, if the person, before passing away, did not have too much pressure in their rectum, doesn't mean that they're going to have a last poop at that point. Their last poop may well have been 3 hours prior to passing away.
And when people are stressed out, they tend to either get constipated or loose motion type things. How does the stress play in?
Sure. So the stressors impact either the sympathetic part of our nervous system or the parasympathetic part of our nervous system. The parasympathetic part of our nervous system plays a role in our secretions. So most of our secretions, be they from tears, be they from nasal mucus, saliva, or internal gland secretions, pancreatic secretions, stomach acid secretions, all of these secretive activities are influenced by our parasympathetic nervous system. The effect of stressors would likely occur by the imbalance that the whole sympathetic, parasympathetic scenario suffers.
When you're stressed out, you have a dry mouth, you probably are secreting less acid into your stomach, you're getting less enzymes from the pancreas and from the gallbladder, and so the whole sludge is just a less liquidy thing. And then when you get to the large intestines, it's reabsorbing, you know, 95% of that less liquidy thing. You're getting a harder end product.
Absolutely. The other effect, of course, is the slowing down of the GI tract that might occur. That allows more water to be reabsorbed if things are not going by as quickly through the large intestine. The more water that gets reabsorbed, the harder the feces is going to get.
It's been great to get the anatomy and function of the GI tract from an anatomist and to get more into detail of how the whole system works. It's been really excellent to talk to you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Nripendra Dhillon, award-winning anatomy professor. Remarkably, it is much easier to find people who are willing to share their stories about their addiction to substances and vices than their bowel habits. I roped in a cousin of mine who prefers to remain anonymous. She generously shares with us her observations on how things go for her. Thank you so much for giving me this interview today.
You're welcome.
Would you be willing to share with us how your digestion works?
Absolutely.
Tell me about how you feel like things get digested in your body.
It really depends on how I eat and how I sleep. If I eat well and sleep well, then my body digests well.
So what constitutes eating well for you?
Vegetables. Lots of vegetables and some fruit. A little bit of meat.
And then you feel like things get processed well and they get eliminated well.
Yes, it's when I eat the food that I shouldn't. Junk food, candy, cookies, too much bread. Doesn't work.
What would you say you mostly eat?
I mostly eat chicken and lots of vegetables. A little bit of bread, but not very much. And it's whole wheat.
And how does the sleep factor in?
If I'm stressing out, then I'm not sleeping. Or if I'm just working too hard and not sleeping, my entire body just doesn't work as well. I guess I just don't relax enough.
So is it the stress or is it the sleep?
It's both.
How can you tell the difference?
Because I get very gassy when I'm stressed. And when I'm sleep deprived, I just don't get anything. I don't feel anything.
So how do you know your digestion isn't working as well if you're sleep deprived?
Oh, because I'm not eliminating anything.
You get constipated.
I do, but not gassy.
So the stress causes gas and the sleep deprivation causes constipation in your case.
Yes, that is true.
Tell me what your average or normal or usual regular pattern is of elimination.
In the morning, I get up about 15 minutes after walking around, having a cup of coffee, I'm ready to go.
Do you purposely walk around? I mean, do you like walk around your house so that you can go? Or is it just kind of your normal, you know, getting ready and getting your morning routine?
It's my normal getting ready routine. But I have noticed that if I jump out of bed and have to run off somewhere and don't have a chance to have a cup of coffee and walk around or do whatever I normally do in the morning, that's when I don't have an opportunity to go to the bathroom or don't give myself the time.
Yeah, so you need time in the morning to kind of warm up and get the engine running a little bit.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Do you think it's the walking around or the coffee?
I'm not sure. I think it's the walking around, actually.
If you skip the coffee, or do you just never skip the coffee?
Oh, no, I skip coffee a lot.
And you still go?
And I still go.
So can you describe the movement? Color, size, consistency, loose, formed, soft, hard. You have to push, it comes out easily, you know, tell me those kind of details.
That's really detailed. Okay, on a good day, you know, when I'm slept well and whatnot, there's no pushing. It's a brown banana. That's what it is.
Is it a brown soft banana or a brown formed banana?
I'd say it's a formed banana. Sometimes I have to push, but not very often, thankfully.
And generally, the size is small, medium, or large?
It's between a small and a medium banana. Except, of course, when I eat cheese and then I get a little bit larger banana.
Okay. You feel satisfied? You feel like you've completely evacuated?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Okay. It's interesting that you notice certain foods have certain different effects.
Yeah. My stomach has given me problems in the past, as you know. So I always pay attention to what I'm eating and how that's going to affect how I eliminate.
Have you noticed certain associations that kind of just come to mind for you right now? Like you said cheese and that gives you a little bigger banana. Have you noticed, oh, you know, when I eat that, that happens. And when I eat that, that happens.
I will say that sometimes when I do get constipated, I was talking to my mom about it the other day and she suggested, you know, half a glass of milk with some cut up dates in it, microwave it. And then I noticed that helps a little bit.
You had mentioned about bread, that sometimes you think bread constipates you a bit.
Yeah, white bread, because I tend to eat more of a whole wheat. But if I'm eating healthy and, you know, what everyone knows you should eat, if I'm eating more like that than what I shouldn't eat, then I'm much better. And I feel better. Mm-hmm. And I feel lighter. My clothes fit better.
Yeah, it's really kind of remarkable, isn't it? How a good bowel movement at any point in the day just suddenly brightens your day.
Oh, yeah, it really is. It really is. You just do feel a little bit of relief.
And you feel, like you said, lighter and brighter and just generally happier.
Yeah.
You had mentioned earlier before we started the conversation that you've been having some issues lately. Would you be willing to share what those issues are?
Oh, sure. It was actually about a month ago when I was talking to my mom and she said, oh, have hot milk, have some dates. And so I went through about 3 weeks of just doing that on a regular basis because I just couldn't. It was hard or it wouldn't come out. And that was a stressful time for me. Getting the milk was not just the process of eating the dates and getting whatever nutritive content that would help my body. It also became the moment to relax at the end of the night. I'm going to go to sleep relaxed, and it helped.
So having a little ritualized time to de-stress.
Absolutely. And before I go to bed, without just dropping into bed exhausted. And
do you ever suffer from diarrhea?
Occasionally I do, but not very often. Usually if I eat too much popcorn with hot, spicy stuff on it.
So it's the hot, spicy things.
Yes.
What about the gas issue you were talking about earlier?
Oh, if I eat bad foods and whatnot, then I will get particularly gassy.
Is it more burping or farting?
Farting. Burping comes with soda.
Okay. So do you have any other digestive habits that you could share with us?
I drink a lot of water. That really helps clean out my system. So yogurt. Somehow yogurt calms my stomach.
How much water do you say you drink a day?
I drink about 8 to 10 glasses. I drink a lot of water.
Anything else on top of that water or just water?
Some coffee. Once in a while, I'll have some tea. I try and stay with the non-carbonated. I don't like to burp.
You said that yogurt calms your stomach. Yeah. Can you explain what you mean about calming it?
Sure. Sometimes if I'm very hungry and I haven't eaten, or first thing in the morning, I can't eat right away. And yogurt's the one thing that will really just gives me enough to calm down whatever is going on in my stomach.
It sounds like you kind of have a little bit of a quote-unquote nervous stomach.
I do. In fact, my mom used to tell me that all the time when I was younger.
What are the symptoms that you experience having a nervous stomach?
Well, it hurts. My stomach starts to hurt. And then if it gets really bad, I'll start to vomit.
That's impressive. You kind of store a lot of stuff in your stomach.
I do. I hear that's a bad thing.
That's actually a quite common thing. We don't have to call it bad or good. It's just common.
Oh, well, that's good to know. I'm normal. Who knew?
It's been very generous of you to share the intimate details of your digestion and elimination process with us. I really appreciate you taking the time to divulge.
I'm happy to. I love your podcast, so of course anything I could do.
Thank you. Generous Anonymous Cousin. Our concluding poem. They say I am beautiful, but beauty fades. They say true beauty is on the inside, but if I look inside, I see pink glistening intestines, moving, writhing, scarlet blood, yellow greasy omentous fat, green slimy bile, soupy oily chyme, liquidy secretions, slippery mucus, crimson flesh, a plump pancreas, and a smooth, shiny liver. Wormy guts full of brown, pungent feces and malodorous gas. I am indeed truly beautiful, wondrously so, and this beauty too shall pass, especially the gas. Nanjing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander. Website set up and design, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and manjira played by Jayasi. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by Jisi Garcia. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jays Productions. Found at gypsyjays.net. JYPSYJAYS.net. You can find us on the web at nanjingnow.org. NEIJINGNOW.ORG. Nanjing Now is an entirely listener-supported endeavor. Please donate generously if these programs are beneficial and enjoyable. Your support is essential to keep this program alive.